Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few offer as much raw intelligence of the old-fashioned kind on matters involving Asia as does our first guest. He is Gordon Chang. He is a renowned authority and go-to guy on the subject of particularly China, but more broadly, this very important part of the world for us, as well as the Daily Beast, and of course Fox News and many others. He is the author of two best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. Always good to have you, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, speaking of North Korea taking on the world, you had a rather provocative piece at the National Interest last week, Gordon, about whether Donald Trump is ready to take on North Korea in the sense of attacking it. Give us a flavor of why you think that may be so and whether, under the circumstances, it is advisable.
Senator Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Republican, has really transmitted many of President Trump's chilling threats to North Korea. And last week he talked about sending a signal to the North Koreans that the United States have a viable military option. This is in connection with comments from other members of the Republican Party and the administration which really constitute war talk. Since I wrote that piece at the National Interest, Senator Graham has also talked about evacuating dependents of American military personnel from the Korean Peninsula and not sending dependents of new personnel. And that will certainly spook the North Koreans. You know, there are many military preparations we need to take, and clearly the North Koreans have to know that we have a military option. But there are so many other things that we should be talking about at this particular time. So, for instance, when President Trump announced the North Korean launch of the Hwasong-15, he mentioned that he had a long conversation with Secretary of Defense James Mattis. I would certainly have liked to have heard President Trump say that he had a long conversation with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, the administration official responsible for enforcing sanctions, because there's a lot that we can do without the use of force to bring North Korea to the point where it understands it has to disarm. And the administration isn't talking sanctions. It's talking about military means.
It does seem to me, Gordon, I know our colleague Admiral Ace Lyons has been recommending for months that we get those dependents out of there, that it would concentrate the mind of both the North and South Koreans, for that matter, and certainly square things away for military action if that's absolutely necessary. Let me ask you about a couple of other things, Gordon. We'll be talking momentarily with our friend Kevin Freeman about some of the indications of the Chinese, who we have constantly been told are our allies in dealing with the North Koreans, and you and I talk about this most weeks. Kevin's very much of the view that the Chinese are now engaged in an increasingly open economic war against the United States. Let me ask you to respond to that sort of proposition generally, and then I want to ask you about some specific aspects of what the Chinese are up to that are very worrying.
Well, there's no question that the Chinese have been conducting a trade war against the United States and other nations, and they've been doing so for a very long time. People in the U.S. Don't understand the nature of this broad-based challenge, and they view this as just normal competition. But China's increasingly predatory practices against American companies and against the U.S. economy, I think, cannot be characterized in any other way. But whatever term one wants to use, we have to understand what China is doing. And that certainly is undermining the American economy. And they're doing that with a sense of malice.
malice and, it seems, increasing purpose. Let me ask you about a couple of things, Gordon. Against the backdrop of that, the president has rejected the, as apparently has the European Union, the idea that the Chinese would be characterized as a market economy for purposes of the World Trade Organization. It seems to me that's self-evident, but it is rather surprising, is it not, that this step is being taken by the United States at the moment when there still does seem to be a lingering hope within at least some quarters of the U.S. government, perhaps including the president, that he'll be able to bring Xi into helping with the North Korean problem. What are your thoughts about the WTO and how it fits into the larger Trump policy agenda?
Well, certainly China is moving away from a market economy, but this is a technical issue. When China joined the World Trade Organization 15 years ago, it had expected that within 15 years, it would be treated as a market economy for purposes of dumping. Dumping is when a country sells products below cost to another country. When there is a dumping complaint, the question is what prices can be used to determine whether a country has, in fact, dumped products. If it's a market economy, the complaining country is restricted in what prices it can use to prove its case. There is language in the WTO accession agreement for China which appears to say that within 15 years, China will automatically get market economy status. And I think that was indeed the interpretation, that was the intention of U.S. negotiators. But, Frank, the language that was actually used in the WTO accession agreement is fuzzed up. And so there is some question from a technical point of view what American negotiators actually, in fact, agreed to. And this is what President Trump is saying. He's taking advantage of this ambiguity in the language to pressure China. The Europeans are also doing this. They eventually may agree formally to market economy status for the Chinese, but they will probably introduce provisions that will indeed make it much more difficult for China to dump products. They've got this concept of disruptive conduct. This is going to be, I think, the central challenge when we look at China, because clearly the Chinese economy, as I mentioned, has become less liberal under Xi Jinping, the current ruler. And so the United States should take advantage of every opportunity we have to oppose market economy status for the Chinese.
Amen. And Gordon, this is, of course, among other things, in the face of Chinese pressure campaigns and lobbying. There was an interesting report about a group called China's United Front Work Department, something I had not heard of before, but that seems to be operating, among other places, in Australia to recruit what it calls friends in the West. What do we know about this United Front Work Department and how it's operating here and to what effect?
Well, the United Front, which is a part of the Communist Party, is an attempt to get support from other nations. And they portray China as a friend, as a defender of the international system, all the rest of it. But what they are using United Front tactics for is undermining democracies, not only Australia's, where they're having some success, but also ours, where they've made substantial inroads. This is another broad-based challenge from Beijing. This one is actually more insidious than the economy because they attack the institutions of our free society with their United Front work. And so the United States has yet to fully understand and oppose United Front tactics of the Chinese in our own country.
What you might call part of the unrestricted warfare of the Chinese against us. Gordon, lastly and very quickly, there is another report in the Wall Street Journal last week about the Chinese using their tech giants to spy on their people. You were one of those who joined us in opposing the initial public offering of Alibaba on the American stock market, and it seems to be playing a prominent role in helping the Chinese maintain their totalitarian control at home and presumably elsewhere as well. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, quickly.
Yeah, of course, the Chinese use every instrument possible to coerce their own people. But there are reports that Chinese products, such as, for instance, drones and surveillance cameras that are used in the U.S., are sending back information to China. So it's not only the Chinese that are being spied on, it's also Americans. And again, we don't understand the full breadth of China's challenge here. And we very well may have to have a ban on Chinese products in order to protect ourselves.
Sure sounds right to me, particularly as there would probably play an increasingly prominent role in the so-called Internet of Things we're getting into. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as visiting with each week. I know you'll keep up the great work at the Daily Beast. Thank you, sir. Good to talk with you. Next up, as promised, Kevin Freeman will get his thoughts on some of these issues and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is one of the country's foremost experts on the phenomenon of global economic warfare. This name of his blog postings at globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is an extraordinary resource, and we're always delighted to have with him each week. Kevin, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Great to be here, Frank.
I want to talk first and foremost, Kevin, about Bitcoin. We touch on it a lot because there seems to be a growing sense that it will emerge as an important currency in the world, in perhaps the future, even a reserve currency. Who knows? But I'm especially struck by an interest that has been taken lately by some very bad actors, one of them being Iran, and the other being Venezuela, not so much in Bitcoin, but I guess in getting its own cyber currency. You've warned about North Korea minting, that is to say, counterfeiting Bitcoins. Give us sort of the lay of the land as you see it at the moment on this so-called cyber currency or cryptocurrency operation.
Well, it is a fact that that every nation of the world is going to have to deal with the idea that currency might not be in the form of paper, it might be in the form of ones and zeros, but it might be in the blockchain, which is that very sophisticated technology where everybody is acknowledging it and it's kept in cyberspace. It's the basis for Bitcoin, which of course has been a dramatic dramatic valuation increase this year, and it's now valued somewhere north of $11,000, where a few years ago it was worth pennies. And it's the idea that perhaps a government can get in on this action. It's not completely in the private sector. And so the Russians have gotten in and said they're going to create their own crypto ruble. Now Venezuela has acknowledged that they're going to develop their cryptocurrency, which is important because their paper currency is worth nothing. And the Iranians have said that they would even accept traditional Bitcoin. And so this is becoming something that's being embraced by enemies of freedom and friends of freedom alike. And it's something that's not going away.
Should we be concerned that these enemies of freedom in particular are getting into this? And especially, Kevin, you tantalized me a couple of weeks ago when you talked about the North Koreans, as I say, being able to essentially defraud the Bitcoin blockchain security system somehow. It sounds as though that would be a serious problem for Bitcoin, is it not?
Well, there are multiple serious problems for Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency. And when you mention North Korea, we're talking about electromagnetic pulse. And that's important because those who here embrace Bitcoin and are concerned about the future of the U.S. dollar and so forth, their one big worry is that if we didn't have a power grid, we have no access to cryptocurrencies. And so the North Koreans might want us, the world, to adopt it because then they would have the ability to shut it off. But they've also been hacking Bitcoin. They've hacked it from South Korea, and they're possibly developing their own.
I guess I'm raising the question to you, if the North Koreans can hack the blockchains of Bitcoin, surely other more sophisticated nations should be able to do the same. And if the whole premise of the currency is that it has this unbeatable cryptologic lock on it. I don't get how it could retain its value, Kevin Freeman. Am I missing something here?
Well, what they're hacking is essentially the wallets that contain the Bitcoin. They're not necessarily hacking the blockchain itself and breaking that down, although with quantum computing, something the Chinese are developing, that's a very real risk. What they're hacking is the wallets where you keep that configuration, that coin that's got the number that identifies you as the holder of that. If they can steal that number, it's like stealing your credit card number and using it. So that's a very real risk. And how you protect once you've established that you own this, how do you protect and maintain that it's yours? And we've seen companies go bankrupt because they weren't able to hold on to the coins.
Got it. Well, this is fascinating, and we will be returning to it with you, Kevin Freeman, often, I'm sure, in the weeks ahead. Let me ask you about another issue involving the internet, and that is the Russians are reportedly now going to set up their own domain name system, which, of course, has been sort of the DNA, I guess you'd call it, of the internet. What is the likelihood that that will happen, and if so, that there will be some kind of independent internet for the so-called BRIC nations, Brazil, India, China, South Africa, as well as Russia, that will compete with the other internet or perhaps make more likely attacks on our internet in the confident expectation that they'll have their own that will be able to function with impunity.
This was a topic that we brought up and we talked about at length a year or so ago when we were giving away the ICANN, the domain naming, to the international body. Now, Russia's just proving our point. They want their own naming conventions that they can have as a backup at a minimum because they don't trust the international body. We shouldn't have trusted it either. We should have maintained control of ICANN. And Russia developing this says that if we got into a serious conflict and that body was opposed to them, in the form of sanctions or whatever, that they want to have the ability to continue to operate business as usual. And this is a very scary thing because it goes against this idea, well, you know, the internet belongs to everybody, we should all share it, and so America, you give up your control. And once we've done that, now the Russians are developing alternatives because they might be willing to take down that control in some way, harm it, go against it, or whatever. They're just proving the point we made a year ago.
Yeah, I hate to say we told you so, but there it is, and it's a very troubling prospect, needless to say. Kevin, let me turn finally to one other issue. One of my favorite institutions in the world is named after one of my favorite bosses, Henry Scoop Jackson. The Henry Jackson Society in the United Kingdom has recently published a report that provides the latest evidence that the Persian Gulf nation of Qatar is still very much in the business of supporting terrorist groups and other Sharia supremacist enterprises like the Muslim Brotherhood. What do we know about this study and its findings, and how much should it further reinforce what seemed to me to be a good idea to begin with, which is the idea of helping the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, and others push back against the Qataris, sanction them or punish them in other ways?
Well, we've been experiencing an information operations war between the Qataris and Turkey and Iran and on the other side, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and so forth. And Qatar's been proclaiming, we have nothing to do with terror. Those are all old links. And yet they maintain the same very prominent players, including Yusuf Qaradawi, who was mentioned specifically in the report, and someone that I ran across that was directly tied to the financial crisis of 2008 with statements like all the wealth is ours, meaning his brand of Islam. So they're absolutely right. The terror continues. The bad actors are still in place. There's been no real change in response to the Saudi Arabian boycotts. There's very little response. They've just stood their ground and continued to tell us that they're not connected to terror. And this report proves otherwise.
Yeah, and gives lie to the memorandum of understanding that Rex Tillerson signed with the Qataris, seemingly confirming that they were back in our good graces. Ain't so. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as for the great work that you do at globaleconomicwarfare.com and with us at the Center for Security Policy, where you are our senior fellow. Thank you so much, Kevin. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Colonel Joe Martin, a veteran of the Kennedy Special Warfare School, in the aftermath of reports that its standards are being changed in a way that could be highly detrimental. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Colonel Joe Martin, United States Army retired, a longtime member of the Army's Special Forces. He is a distinguished military officer who has a great number of accomplishments to his credit during his time in the Army, and I can't do justice to it and leave time to to talk to him about the subject at hand. But among other things, in the course of his 26 years of active duty, he was responsible for establishing the Special Operations Preparation Course, which was designed to ensure that people coming in off the street were ready for their Special Forces assessment and selection. He is also the author of a book on the subject, Get Selected, How to Successfully Complete Assessment and Selection for the Special Forces. Joe Martin, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
Joe, you have a lot of experience with the Kennedy School, where you were, among others, a member of the faculty. There is a report that was published by SOFREP, a blog that serves the special operators community, written by somebody who seems to have a lot of knowledge about what's going on at that school at the moment, in particular with respect to the training curriculum for those coming into the Special Forces in the Army, that suggests that there's some serious problems with what's being done with respect to the standards that folks like you were expected to meet. What is going on here, Joe, and how significant a problem do you think it represents?
Thanks for having me on, Frank. I appreciate the opportunity. It is an interesting and explosive allegation. I've read through it. It's clear that whoever the author is currently serving as an instructor at the Special Warfare Center and School, probably within the training group itself, which is responsible for the Special Forces qualification course and producing Green Berets, quite frankly, that our operational military force needs right now. It's a mighty fine slice of ham that only has one side. I'm convinced there's two sides to the story. It is clear by the length and depth of the letter itself and all the allegations that this is one of the strengths of the Special Forces Regiment. Our instructors, Green Berets, are smart, and they care about the quality of the soldier that they produce. If they didn't, you wouldn't see an instructor taking his own time to put something like this together.
And potentially putting his career on the line if he's found out and punished for it, no?
Potentially, yes. Full disclosure, I worked with Major General Linder at one point when he was the deputy commander of the training group. I worked with Major General Sontag when he was my battalion commander and I was a company commander. And I worked with Colonel Mike Kornberger on the joint staff. So I know many of the people who are being accused of reducing the standards here. But the extensive nature of the specifics in the letter that he wrote make it worthy of an investigation, not into who wrote it, but rather what are the specific incidents and why they happened.
And Joe, as you see it, why is it happening? What is this officer warning about? Is it that women are being brought in and the standards have to be reduced in order to ensure that they pass? Is it that we're not recruiting high enough quality recruits anymore, that they're not fit or in other ways unsuited for the rigorous demands of the Special Forces? And as a guy who, you know, has spent a lot of time in not only meeting those standards, but also helping others understand why they're important, can we safely dumb them down and not, you know, reap the whirlwind in terms of people who just aren't up to the jobs they're going to be assigned?
Well, you're right. There is a concern if the standards were to be lowered. But the Special Forces in particular prides itself on a constantly evolving course. And so some of the things that were complained about in the letter, as an example, when is graduation within the course of the pipeline, shows that the instructor's a little bit younger and wasn't aware that things changed throughout the time. So when I came through the qualification course, you know, the Q course itself was 6 months long, and at the end of it, you got your Green Beret, and then you went to language school, and then you went to survival school, and then you went to group. And so at some point later on, they decided we would do the Special Forces graduation after language school. So that's when you got your Green Beret. Well, they moved it back to the end of the qualification course in front of language school. And so he said, oh, this is awful. This is a massive change. It's just things going back to the way that they were long before this instructor probably joined the Army. And so there are going to be evolutions like that.
But that doesn't result in reduction of standards, does it? That's just a sort of the training timeline.
Right. And that it doesn't. And so one of the things he complains about is a reduction in standards and this requirement to climb a rope wearing 25-pound vest. Well, you know, when I graduated the qualification course, that wasn't a requirement. So someone added that at some point, and now that has been moved to a different point in the course. Instead of at the beginning, it's at the end. So the standards, if they are in fact remain, then there's not a problem. The question becomes, you know, we have a very intense assessment and selection process. It's about 3 weeks. And most of the attrition is supposed to happen there, washing out people who are not physically fit or mentally strong enough to complete the training. But the graduate from a Special Forces Assessment Selection is someone who's physically fit and able to land, navigate, carry heavy weight for long distances. That doesn't necessarily mean that he has the mental capacity or the emotional stability to handle providing high-stress medical procedures under fire, right? So different standards. There should be some attrition throughout the Q course. If you can't do that, maybe you're not cut out to be a combat medic. You need to be a combat engineer or a special forces engineer. And that frequently will happen. People will change what their specialties are. But if there's no attrition happening after assessment and selection, that tells me that there's a problem. And so it's something that needs to be investigated. This is a good first start in General Sontag's response, but I look forward to reading a more thorough response to what the investigation is into the allegations and what's happened.
Let me just make sure I'm clear. So General Sontag is the commanding general of the Kennedy School at the moment. Is that right?
The Special Warfare Center and School, yes.
Okay. And so he is the guy responding to this call for an investigation of whether standards are being changed. And how did he respond, Joe Martin, to this call?
So he wrote, the original allegation was about 10 pages. He wrote about 2.5-page response to it and said that he's aware and he stands behind the quality of the graduates, that he would serve willingly with any of them. And that's one of the allegations is, hey, here's the problem. Officers are making decisions on the training standards, and the officers involved aren't going to be going to combat with any of these soldiers. They will serve underneath them, but they will not actually be getting shot at. We, the instructors, you know, from their perspective, as this instructor who wrote is probably an E7, maybe an E8, we'll go back into the operational groups and we'll go into combat and be shot at with these graduates. And so they have skin in the game, per se, is his argument. Whereas, you know, the officers do not necessarily.
Let me just put a fine point on this, Joe, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. This unnamed author warns, quote, "Shameless and immodest careerism has in no uncertain terms effectively destroyed our ability to assess, train, and prepare students, or to identify those students that pose very real risk to operational detachments. I cannot stress how systematic and severe the effects on the force will be if the standards recently implemented here in the Special Forces Qualification Course remain in place," unquote. Just give me, you know, 30 seconds in response to that, Joe. If beyond the point that it needs to be investigated, do you think it's possible that that's true?
Well, if the standards have been removed as alleged, then yes, that's a problem. So we have an instructor saying that the standards have been removed. We have General Sontag saying, no, they haven't. They've been changed or moved from point to point. And until we get to ground truth, I can't tell you the answer to that.
Okay. Well, we'll have to reserve judgment, too, with you, and we'll look forward to getting your further thoughts on it. Joe Martin, distinguished Special Forces alumnus of the Army and a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you so much, Joe, for your time today and your great service to our country. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Dan Perkins, another Army veteran, about a new book and about the Uranium One scandal. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dan Perkins, now quite renowned author. He is an accomplished novelist, notably with his series The Brotherhood of the Red Nile and Ted Baker in Terrorist Gold. He is a money manager by training. He is also a man who has rendered both in his own right as a serviceman and as a helpmate to other veterans with his Stories for Soldiers program, a fellow who's been rendering a real service to our country, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Dan, thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Let me ask you first about your new book, Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? What's it about, and tell me how it's being received.
It's being received extremely well. It's only been out about a week. It's filling a void. When we think about dementia today, we have over 5 million people over the age of 65 that have been diagnosed. There are probably more, but 5 million people diagnosed. And the National Alzheimer's Association projects by 2050, 33 years from now, that it may be as many as 50 million seniors with Alzheimer's. In fact, if you make it to 85, you have a 1 in 2 chance to get dementia. So what I'm doing here is I'm becoming the champion for the forgotten people. And Frank, why I say the forgotten people is that when parents are responsible for trying to take care of grandma and grandpa, when the situation happens that grandma or grandpa or both can no longer handle for reasons of memory and other factors as a result of dementia, they concentrate a great deal of their efforts and time and energy on taking care of grandma and grandpa. And I'm not begrudging that. Problem, though, is that the children, the grandchildren or great-grandchildren are left behind. I told you in the pre-show, I just did a presentation on the book to 140 fourth graders in outside of Cincinnati. And I was amazed at the number of children that were aware of dementia, the number of children who had grandparents that either had or have dementia. And when I talk to them about what's really the message I want to say is that we ignore or don't give enough time to help explain in language that children can understand what is happening to grandma. They think if grandma doesn't talk to them, doesn't mention their name, they've done something wrong. And it was almost unanimous in the class. The kids felt that way. And I said to them, it's not your fault. And so what this book tries to do is to help parents talk to their children and the children to read and understand at their level. And then the last thing is there are 12 activities that families can do starting tomorrow to begin to preserve the memory of grandma and grandpa.
Wow. Again, a really extraordinary service. And Dan Perkins, I just want to say you're talking about the forgetting people, but indeed they are the forgotten people, and we need to help everyone understand that and remember them properly. Dan, let me turn to matters close to our hearts. There was a story that came out over the weekend that Robert Mueller, the special counsel looking into the alleged and elusive charge that Donald Trump campaign engaged in some kind of collusion with the Russians, had to be removed from his role because of concerns that he was unable to contain or conceal his hostility towards the president. There have been rumors for some time that the population of the prosecutors in this investigation is pretty much comprised of such folks as well. maybe a little less overt about it. But what are your thoughts on this development and perhaps what it means more generally about this prosecution?
Well, I think it raises the question, and I've been talking about this particular issue, and it's related to not only the Clinton Foundation, but also the Uranium One deal. There is a special committee made up of cabinet officers that has the responsibilities called the CFIUS Committee to review all possible sales of strategic assets by the U.S. government to another government or another entity. That's made up of various cabinet officers, including the Attorney General of the United States. At that particular time, in October of 2010, it was Eric Holder. Now, I've done a lot of research on this, and I'm asking this question. The FBI knew that there were money laundering and racketeering charges against people who were involved in the Uranium One deal before the vote. And so I'm asking this first question. If Eric Holder was the Attorney General and the FBI was conducting that investigation, then why didn't he bring it to the attention of the CFIUS members, who probably would not have necessarily voted for the sale of the Uranium One deal? But here's the twist, Frank. Who was the director of FBI that oversaw that investigation?
It's so squirrely. And Rod Rosenstein, the guy who's now the number two at the Justice Department, and as you know, Dan Perkins was responsible for setting up Robert Mueller as the special counsel to look into this presidential question of collusion, was also up to his eyeballs in this, what seems to me to be a cover-up. And whether CFIUS, you know, knew and ignored this, or whether they were unable to obtain all of the information they should have had, it is a signal example of malfeasance, it seems to me, on the part of the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and the Attorney General, Eric Holder. But let me ask you about the current situation, Dan, because when you look at this ongoing investigation, it seems, especially with the guilty plea by Mike Flynn last week, that there's just not very much there. But the prosecution, nonetheless, is going on, and it seems as though it's made up of people like this lead investigator. Am I wrong in arriving at that conclusion? And does it suggest that there's really a conflict on top of conflicts of interest here?
No question about that. And I wrote a piece called Four Questions That the House Intelligence Committee Needs to Make, Ask James Comey. If Mueller was, in fact, the director of the FBI, and he reports into the Attorney General, then I can't believe that a high-profile possible case of selling uranium assets to a foreign corporation would not have been communicated from the director of the FBI to the Attorney General.
Yeah, not just a foreign corporation, a Russian corporation, for God's sake.
That's true. Yes, but the point is if the director of the FBI knew what was going on in his agency, then an issue of this magnitude, knowing that there was a vote coming for the sale of the asset, I can't imagine why he would not have reported that situation to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General, as a member of that committee, I believe has a legal and moral obligation to advise, because after the transaction was completed, this is another part of the story, Bill Clinton was hired by the investment bank that brokered the deal to do a speech in Moscow for $500,000.
$500,000 for one lousy speech.
Right. And on top of that, the Clinton Foundation received from the principals in the deal $145 million contribution. And Hillary is right when she says, well, those contributions took place after the deal was done. Yeah, it was because the deal was done is why the contributions came. And the other piece of that puzzle, Frank, is that if you look at what's happened to the Clinton Foundation, they shut down. They laid off 22 people. They petitioned to the state of New York Attorney General to close down. And people and organizations and governments who had pledged to make contributions, ongoing contributions, are backing away. And the Swedish government was bold enough to come out and say, well, we're not making any more contributions because she can't do anything for us, which is a clearly pay for play.
Exactly right. Hey, Dan, we are hard out of time, but there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again soon. And in the meantime, I want to commend everyone check out at Amazon, Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? It's a hugely important topic by Dan Perkins, needless to say. And Dan, I appreciate so much all you do, especially your stories for soldiers. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.